The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. This week, Bain publisher Tony Weisskopf recaps the last year of amazing works Bain has published and gives us a sneak preview of spring 2026. Her dogs are so excited, they get a few words in too. And later, we continue with the serialization of One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 43.
Hi, my name's Tony Weisskopf from the publisher of Bain Books, and I'm here to do a little recap of 2025. That's the year we are in now. 2026 is the year we are scheduling, and we'll talk a little bit about what's coming ahead in just a minute. But right now, let's go ahead and just take a little stroll back in 2025. We kicked off the year with our Stephen Lawhead program. We had a new novel in Lawhead's Arthurian series, a prequel about Arthur's mother, Aurelia, which I thought was just fantastic. There's a tie-in video program that we are anticipating at any moment. So watch YouTube. They've already got a trailer out, and we're hoping to see that release come as well. We also put back into print the first three books of that Arthurian trilogy for 2025. So those are available in trade paperback and mass market. Then we climbed the top of the mountain in February. We got Heart of the Mountain by Larry Correa. Larry brought his epic fantasy, the saga of the Forgotten Warrior, to a close. Just stuck the landing. Absolutely fantastic. Six book series. If you are a fan of epic fantasy, you're going to be very, very happy. If you're just a fan of great writing, you're also going to be very, very happy. Wonderful stuff in February. We had also The Miranda Conspiracy by James Cambius, hard science fiction. It's a little foreshadowing for what's to come a little bit later. Endangered Species by Charles Gannon brought that back in trade paperback. In March, we had Friends Indeed by David Weber and Jan Linscold. It was nominated for a Dragon Award for Best YA this year. Didn't win, but we are very proud of that series. It's an early Honorverse series following a young Stephanie Harrington. 1637, The French Correction by Eric Flint and Walter Hunt also came out in March. We also had 1637, The Pacific Initiative by Ivor Cooper come out in March. So we were heavy on The Ring of Fire in March. Sometime in the Fall came out by John Van Stry, who's just writing Heinleinian adventure for us, near future, near space adventure. He does other stuff as well as an indie, but for us, he's writing Heinlein type adventure. Really enjoyed that. In April, we had a new book out by Sharon Lee and Steve Miller, Diviner's Bow. Yes, I want to say bow, but it's bow. Diviner's Bow in the new entry in the Lee Aden series. It's a long-running, wonderful space opera series. If you are new to Lee Aden and wanting to figure out where the best place is to dive in, we have a flowchart for you. We'll be featuring the flowcharts that we have on our social media as well, but you can find them on the website. The Icarus Coda by Timothy Zahn, speaking of sticking the landing for six-book series. Tim Zahn did that for his... it's hard to say what genre they are other than science fiction, right? They're capers. They're portals. They're space opera. They have fun aliens. They're kind of like Star Trek. It's science fiction. It's by Tim Zahn. You should read it if you haven't already. Also, in April, we had Across the Sea of Stars, a Black Tide Rising novel by neuroscientist and researcher Rob Hampson. Finding out what the zombie apocalypse did to Hawaii. Not all good things. Not all good things indeed. Moving into summer, we had the start of a new superhero series by John Ringo called Not That Kind of Good Guy. He's not Superman. He's not Batman. He's not that. He's not those kind of good guys. He's a uniquely Ringo kind of good guy. Also in May we had Rhymer by Greg Frost. That one, Rhymer Hell. So that one is set in Elizabethan England. John Dee, Evil Elves, wonderful, wonderful stuff. Mage Light by Casey Azell, the start of our Go Feral for Fantasy program, came out in May. If you haven't gone Feral for Fantasy yet, you should, and you should start there. Fenrir by Eric Flint and Reich Spohr came out in June. It's a hard science fiction novel, standalone. We are Bane, but we can do standalone novels if we absolutely have to. And that's a close encounter with alien objects that's coming out of from above the galactic ecliptic, moving fast and making moves that don't seem natural. This obviously could never happen in real life. I jest. but in this case, the novel explains what is going on. Second installment in our Feral for Fantasy, Rise from Ruin by Melissa Althoff, came out in June. And that that one, fans of Anne McCaffrey are just reveling in this. Melissa was very much inspired by Anne McCaffrey, as was Casey Azell. And it absolutely shows in this post-apocalyptic fantasy with dragons and griffins and an adventure. In July, we had the second installment in Steve Sterling's Alternate History. Thank you, little bit. Yes. Yes, you're just the best doggy in the whole world. No, you're not. That's Daphne, but you're pretty good. So, all right. In July, we had The Winds of Fate by Steve Sterling, the second installment in his alternate Roman fantasy. Just settle. Come on. There we go. All right. In July, we had The Winds of Fate by Steve Sterling, S.M. Sterling, the second installment in his Roman fantasies, alternate histories. They are just Steve Sterling in classic form, lovely battle scenes, and thoughtful alternate history, well researched. The President's Malign by Michael Merceau is the third in his military far future science fiction trilogy. And we had The Long Way Home by Patrick Childs, the second installment in his Interstellar Medic series. Also, brand new in July was Dancing with Destruction, edited by Jason Cordova, which was an all-original anthology of stories inspired by a Kurt Miller painting. In August, we had Behind the Veil, number 3 in the Transdimensional Hunter series by John Ringo and Lydia Scherer. That's a fairly near future adventure with a young gamer protagonist. And she and her companions are starting to realize that it's not just all fun and games in the gaming world. Things are starting to become more and more clear what is behind the veil. And we had The Well of Fate by Aaron Haskins, A.C. Haskins, another one of our Go Feral for Fantasy installments. This one's inspired by Irish folklore and Irish mythology with a completely American protagonist. A grizzled veteran who just does not want to get dragged into this anymore, but it's just one more time. Probably more. There'll be more down the road. Let's see. In fall, we are falling hard for science, hard science fiction. But before we do, we're going to keep on going feral for fantasy, and we have Black Tie and Tales, a brand new novel by Gwen Spencer, and her Black Wolves of Boston werewolf series, and A Plague of Magic by Marisa Wolfe, which, despite her name, is not a werewolf story. We have the... that's a reprint. Oh, we also had Swords and Larceny by David Asharad and Mark Finn, all original fantasy capers. great anthology, wonderful, wonderful stories. Marisa has a story in there as well. In October, where we are now, or, you know, where I am now at least, Welcome to the Jungle by Don Ringo and Casey Moores, which is the second installment in that not that kind of good guy superhero story. Casey's got a little more writing and collaborating in this one than he did in the first. Casey's going to be our overall continuity editor, as you would need for a TV show, and a co-author with John Ringo as we move forward on this series. We have Gold Dust, a brand new novel by Catherine Asaro, and that is indeed the first of our Fall Hard for Hard Science Fiction program in 2025. We'll talk more about them. We've got a whole program dedicated to those authors. And also in October we have The Familiar Spirit by DJ Butler and Aaron Michael Ritchie, and that brings a very satisfying conclusion to their Dust Bowl fantasy trilogy. There may be more with these characters later on, but the whole arc, the whole sequence, reads very well together as the three books together. In November, we have Challenges, Tales from the Earliest Days of the Star Kingdom, original anthology of Honorverse stories, including stories by David Weber himself, Marisa Wolfe, Jacob Hollow, and Tom Pope, and a new to the series, Daniel Butler. No relation to DJ Butler. We also had Perdition Storm by Brian Trent, a Black Tide Rising novel. In this case, we're finding out what the zombies do to Rome. Again, not good things. Not good things are happening, but we are trying to rebuild civilization one city at a time. And we also had Ringer by Joelle Presby, which is near future, near space. And a young protagonist. We have a young girl who is left behind as her younger brothers and parents go off to have adventures, and she is the one who is stuck with the grandparents. It's not easy. I'm just saying, it's not easy. I feel for this character. So we round out the year with The Augustine Text by Tim Powers. It's another standalone.
What? Bills of the Gods.
What?
Bills of the Gods.
Ah, yes. Yeah, I'm looking at an old schedule. And we round out the year with The Mills of the Gods by Tim Powers. It's a standalone fantasy. It's set in post-World War I Paris for the most part. We will see familiar characters like Ernest Hemingway and Gertrude Stein. And they are supporting characters for our heroes who are fighting a ages-old cabal of people who use children for vile purposes. Lovely adventure by Tim Powers coming out in December. And we also have Dragons Gone Wild by Dan Cobalt, which is the third in his Build a Dragon sequence. We have genetic engineering, people bringing back, wanting to bring back the woolly mammoth and other kinds of creatures that are lost to us. Dan Cobalt has taken the next logical step. If you can do that, then you can also build fantasy creatures. And so we are now exploring what the consequences are of actually building dragons. So that was our 2025. I have to say, I think there's some good reads, some really good reads in there. I'm very proud of what we've done for 2025. Looking ahead to 2026, can we do that? Can we look ahead a little bit? All right, here we are, looking ahead to 2026. I'm very excited about how we're kicking off 2026 as well. We've got The Bronze Legion, Volume 1, by Jason Cordova and Melissa Altoff. We saw Melissa in 2025 with her post-apocalyptic fantasy. Now she's writing adventure, science fiction, I say it's pure military science fiction. They say it's adventure. You guys read. You decide. You see if I'm right or not. The first volume is called To Tread Obsidian Shores, and it's essentially a French Foreign Legion in space is sort of the inspiration for that. We have Tom Kratman. He's been thinking about Rome, and that's a good thing. For the eternal glory of Rome is his take on an alternate history of Rome, where the legions of Varus, who were lost to history, we don't know where they went, but they did not show up at a crucial battle. Tom has the explanation, it's if you enjoy... If you enjoy any kind of military science fiction, you are going to enjoy For the Eternal Glory of Rome. In February, we have book four, the final in the sequence of The Transdimensional Hunter by John Ringo and Lydia Scherer. It's called Beyond the Rift. So you'll notice that we published volume three and volume four pretty close together. You can get the e-arc for that now. If you just want to binge the whole series, I suggest you do. It's lovely. Oh, actually, you can't get the e-arc now, but you will soon. You will very soon. Also in February, we have a... By the time this comes out, there should be a New York for you. The Red Line Heist by Michael Merceau is also in February. It's a standalone adventure. It's got classic cars, hot chicks, and near space adventure. So I can't wait to read it. Also in spring, we have The Monster Hunter Files, edited by Larry Correa and Jason Cordova. These are all original stories in the Monster Hunter International series, including a new story by Larry himself, new stories by Jason Cordova, and by Mike Massa, writing in that universe. So great stuff. Marisa Wolf also has... I believe, the cover story for that one, Mermaids in the Monster Hunter International universe. They're not nice. They're not nice. Also coming out in March, we have the sequel to Ballistic, Apogee by Travis Taylor. It is a near future space adventure in a future where we have an evil billionaire who is trying to blackmail the Earth into his own... evil, we think, goals, and a small band of Marines and Space Force and overachievers are trying to figure out what it is that he's doing and how we can stop him from doing that. Now, obviously, again, we would never have crazy billionaires who would try to blackmail the Earth into doing what they want. It's completely unrealistic, but it is great fun by Travis Taylor. Plausibly Deniable, a nice segue into Plausibly Deniable by Jamie Ibsen. It's a brand new original anthology edited by Jamie Ibsen, who was an intern here at Bain for a few months, and we're pleased to see that the lessons of his interning with our very experienced anthologist Hank Davis have taken, and he is going he's applied them to Plausibly Deniable. He's a very talented young man, and he also designed the cover as part of his internship with experienced cover designer Carol Russo. So we're very proud of Jamie. Coming up in April, The Ship Who Dared by Mercedes Lackey and Veronica Giguere. And this is a new novel in the Ship Who Sang universe that was created by Anne McCaffrey. It's a sequel to The Ship Who Searched that Mercedes Lackey wrote with Anne McCaffrey years ago. And it's taking up where that book left off. I love that universe. I love that concept. And we're really happy to have Mercedes Lackey writing science fiction again, because I think she writes science fiction really, really well. Also in April, the sequel to Magelight, Blood on the Sand, by Casey Azell. This is... Casey's really... fleshing out her fantasy universe in this one. We get to see more of our heroine and her three companions, and it's just a wonderful fantasy adventure. And also in April, we have Twin Star by Mike Kupri, which is a, believe, standalone science fiction novel, far future, far space adventure, inspired by the fiction of P.G. Wodehouse and the adventures of Bertie and Jeeves, in part. So that's what we've got coming up for you in spring. Again, we've got lovely originals, some good reads, and just all across the spectrum of genres in science fiction. So I hope you guys enjoy, and good reading.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Mackin, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
I paused, knowing security was on the way, because with a quick IR scan, I'd spotted some too cool temperature detection wall and floor sections, as well as a few failing motion sensors that shined as hot pinpricks. The owners needed to run physical level maintenance checks on their security gear more often. First to reach me was a short, thin fellow who moved with the precise jumpy motions of the overstimmed, a man with neurochemical augmentations that rendered him deadlier than he appeared. Obvious security guys, hands on holstered weapons, followed a couple of seconds later. I stood very still, hands out from my sides. "I'd like to make a significant purchase," I said. "All our currently available merchandise is behind you," the short man said. He spoke like he moved, words clipped, phrases staccato, each sound precise. "What I need is custom," I said. "We strictly obey all customization laws," he said. I laughed. I couldn't care less. Nothing in the customization I want is, to the best of my knowledge, illegal for you to perform. I didn't have time to meet the right people in town, so I'd have to speed my way through this with brute conversational force. "What I do with my purchases is not your business. What is your business is what I'm willing to pay, which is well above your going rates." I pointed at my pocket. "I'm going to get my wallet." He nodded his approval. I pulled out the wallet and thumbed a link to my local bank. I'd priced the canine versions earlier, added a sizable premium, and set up an account that contained the result. I brought up the balance, obscured the account's number, but left the bank's logo visible, and turned the wallet toward him. "This amount is ready to move to your local bank," I said, "once I have the animals I want, as long as I get them quickly." He glanced at the screen, then at me. "What exactly do you want?" "You engineer monitor dogs, right?" I said. "Yes, of course," he said, "and cats and snakes and pretty much anything else you might like. It's generally standard stuff, organic fluid drop lens cameras bound into the eyes, transmitters feeding off the optic nerves, though it tends to lead to short lives for the pets." He shook his head. "What you showed me is way too much for monitors, even a herd of them." "No," I said, "it's not. I need monitor birds." He cut me off. "Again, standard. What are you really?" I returned the favor. "I need a flock of them," I said. "Local, something common in the woods northwest of the city, plus enough controls to force them to follow a course I'll describe, and a wrangler to take them up and bring them back." I paused for breath, and this time he let me finish. "And I need it all without any transmissions of any sort, not for control, not for what they monitor. I need the absolute minimum amount of metal possible, onboard silicon or other non-metal recorders, and all the recordings in my hands afterward, no one else sees the data. Pre-jump organic recorders? He asked. Why not simply transmit? He stopped and waved his hand, stopping me before I could speak. Not my concern, of course. After you're done with the birds, I'll use them only once, and then they're yours. But the data is, as I said, exclusively mine. He smiled for the first time. The payment makes more sense. We've helped with similar work, of course, but nothing with tech this old. We also, as you might expect, want nothing to do with the end product of your project. Though, as I think about it, not having the data flow in real time is only good for us. Yes, I said, and I don't want you involved. It's a one-time run, then we're done. You take away the birds and do what you want with them. Fair enough, he said. We can do business. Got a particular bird in mind? No, I said. As long as whatever you choose is common enough that no one tracking the flock will think twice about it flying overhead, I'll be happy. He thought for a few seconds. Blue-beaked moseys. They're everywhere outside the city. They move around frequently. A loud noise will send a flock flapping to a new location, and they fly at all times from first light until fairly late at night. They move relatively slowly, so the images should be clear. They'll home for multiple clicks after only a couple of feedings, so training is quick and range is good. Plus, they're easy to work on, with heads large enough that laser and cellular quick-heal techniques all work. Fine, I said. One last complication. I need full-spectrum recording, visible and IR. He smiled again. You're new to working with animals. Of course you do. That's standard on this type of augmentation. When do you need all this? This evening, I said, half statement and half question. Not a chance, he said. A day to prepare and heal the flock, plus a day for the wrangler to work out his approach and do the homing training once you identify the start and end points. I hated the delay, but he was right. It was never going to happen today. Maybe I'd get lucky in the interim, and Chung would change his habits and give me an open shot at him. Unlikely, but I could hope. Okay, I said. A quarter now, another quarter when they take off, and the remaining half when I have all the recordings. A third now, he said, to help with upfront costs. Then take us to half when the wrangler's in position and pay the balance when he hands you all the recordings. He agreed so quickly that I realized I should have started with a lower offer and haggled. But the money pain was still tolerable. I needed Zycheck to lift the bounty on me, and getting to Chung was the only way I knew to make that happen. I nodded my agreement, thumbed up a transfer of a third, and opened my wallet to accepting a destination code from his. Done, I said. Give me the account to transfer to, then we'll work out our communication protocols, and you can get me some birds. Over the next 3 days, Chung kept to his routine, and Lobo and I clung to ours. We spent the nights in a variety of geosync low-orbit positions, Lobo maintaining transmission cover by echoing weather data or acting as a free public data SAT repeater, his sensors trained on Chung's house on the off chance that our target would surprise us with an easy opportunity. Chung didn't. In the days we flew with a tourist shuttle crowd, up and down the coastal cliff and outlying forest tour routes, Lobo's camo washing him with a different set of corporate colors every few hours. Chung's security team kept to its proven practices, and we never even came close to a low collateral damage shot at him. As the time wore on, the beauty of the cliff structures faded into unseen background, then eventually decayed into visual annoyance. Choose to look at a piece of art 1,000 times, and each glance may reveal new beauty. Let a job force you to study it when you're aching to move on to the next task, and only those rare pieces that touch you most deeply will remain lovely. I invested part of each evening in studying Lobo's low-orbit recon images of a 15-kilometer diameter circle centered on Chung's estate, trying to balance my conflicting desires. For the obvious safety reasons, I wanted starting and ending coordinates that were as deserted as reasonably possible, but I also needed a flight line that passed over as many homes and businesses as possible. Should the strange kitty team be tempted to double-dip by offering intel about me to the possible targets, I wanted them to have to wonder which of many options I was scanning. Alerting all the possibilities would, I hoped, open them to more exposure than they'd like. I finally settled on a not-quite-10-kilometer path that started a couple of clicks off the road in a light-density forest and ran over three small business concentrations and five estates, roughly on par with Chung's. The end point was the far edge of the warehouse portion of one of the business areas. Not ideal, but acceptable, given that we'd be launching in the dying light of the day when Chung would most likely be home. I stretched out the route choice to maintain my focus on the task. I've never enjoyed waiting for a job to start. Waiting is fine when I can use the time to gather new intel. It can also be a pleasurable activity when I'm not working. I love idle time and can while away weeks observing a new starscape or ocean, as I've been doing on Mackin before all this started. But such lazy days are fun only when what I've chosen to do is be idle. I was on my first run up the coast one morning and way past ready to get to work when the strange kitty folks posted the signal my birds were ready. An advertisement for a one-day limited quantity price reduction on mini dragons with self-regulating homeostatic systems that would work in anything from a blizzard to a heat wave. I'd suggested a protocol that wouldn't risk costing them money, but my salesman had assured me that they'd overstocked the mini dragons and would love it if the special offer boosted sales. To avoid attracting undue attention, Lobo and I finished the tour route we were running, called Strange Kitty, and worked our way cautiously to a location where Lobo could safely drop me. 2 hours before the projected launch time, I met the Strange Kitty team, my salesman and the wrangler, at the coordinates I'd given them. They arrived in a heavily shielded company transport truck that contained my birds and a dozen other animals of various types, all sedated. The men sported strange kitty uniforms in ad-woven active fabric, images of augmented creatures of all types slithering over the clothing. Had anyone stopped them, they explained, they would have been able to produce a full schedule of deliveries. I nodded appreciatively at their caution. My salesman appeared exactly as amped as he had at the store. The wrangler, an even shorter man who was enough of a bird fan to have back feathers that peaked above the collar of his coverall, moved almost as if asleep. A byproduct, he explained, of the chemically enhanced calming mosey pheromones he'd washed with before loading the birds. "I'd like to verify the recording capability," I said. The air was hot, thermals playing almost visibly in the slow-moving atmosphere. This far inland, we received all the heat of a tourist coastal city, but none of the cooling ocean breeze. "Of course," my salesman replied. They opened the back of the truck and led me inside. Its rear half was a large cage full of moseys, squawking and flapping and jumping about. As the wrangler walked over to the cage, however, the pheromone assault calmed the birds, and they settled on some of the many dark wooden perches that extended from the bars, walls, and ceilings of the caged area. He took out one of the moseys and absently stroked its head, the bird lying as still and happy in his arms as a spent lover. A little under a third of a meter long, and with a wingspan of over a meter, the mosey was bigger than I'd expected. At first glance, as we entered the truck, I'd thought the moseys to be plain, basically gray animals, with only the blue beaks to break up the color monotony. Now, with the time to look closely, I saw that their feathers eased through a gentle color transition from dark gray at the tips to a blend of lighter grays, and finally to a blue so close to gray It was as if the merest few drops of blue pigment had fallen in a can of gray paint. Here and there on the bird's underside were flecks of white and black frequent enough that they invited the thought of a pattern, but not any pattern I could discern. Not showy animals, but ones that repaid close inspection, beautiful in their own way. I realized then, as I have at many such moments in the past, that the same has proven true of every living thing I've ever taken the time to study closely, a testimony to the wonder of creation. I know many people crave explanations for the glories of the universe, but I don't. What I crave is the will and the ability to learn to appreciate it all. The wrangler interrupted my reverie. "It couldn't be simpler," he said. He parted the feathers on the left side of the bird's neck to reveal a small stud, pressed the stud, and pointed the animal's head at me. After a few seconds, he pressed the stud again, then hooked a small viewing port to it. The bird, still happily pheromone drunk in his arms, the screen snapped alive with multi-windowed images of me in visible IR and composite frequencies. "They're trained for the end coordinates," I said. "Of course," said the wrangler, his pride obviously offended. As he put the mosey back in its cage, he continued, "We've made 3 other deliveries in that area earlier today. Each time, we've fed them and established the destination for them. They're superb homing beasts, so that might have been enough. To make sure, though, we installed some of our proprietary tech." He must have seen my eyes widen, for he quickly added, "Non-metal, of course, in every bird in the flock. They'll work, or you owe us nothing." "And you'd refund my previous payments?" I said, addressing the question to the salesman. "Of course." "Excellent," I said. I counted the birds. 19 were in the cage. I'd expected more. "Why only 19? The wrangler's look ratcheted from offended to annoyed. "Because it felt right," he said. "For moseys, these woods, this time of year, this time of day, it felt right. It's what I do." "My apologies," I said, meaning it. I'd asked out of reflex, not thought, and if I was going to question their expertise, I should have done the research in advance to be able to do so intelligently. I took out my wallet, thumbed what I owed them, and showed it to the salesman. After finishing the transfer, he said, "When do we launch?" "When I call you," I said, "which will be in less than 2 hours. I want to be at the end point before you release them. No point in taking the risk of transportation issues messing up the schedule. Who from your end will be with me?"
"I will," the wrangler said. "Launching requires only opening the exterior cage access panel in the side of the truck, so he'll handle it. The moseys will handle it from there." "I assume you can take me and my equipment bags, yes?"
"Yes." I didn't see him as a threat, and having a hostage could prove useful should something go wrong. "Let's go." To the salesman, I added, "I'll call when we're in position and the time is right." The trip to the endpoint went smoothly, no traffic, and, to my delight, no probing chatter from the wrangler. I invested some of the available transit time in counter-ground surveillance, side trips, and detours, and neither I nor Lobo, who was tracking me from one of his low-orbit posts, could spot anyone following. Lobo couldn't get detailed enough data for me to be completely comfortable, but that was fine. Too much comfort in a mission is a dangerous thing. As the sun was fading and the day's light deepening in tone and multiplexing in color, playing a visual symphony, transitioning from unnoticed backdrop to in-your-face beauty, I made the call. The wrangler anticipated less than half an hour before the birds would reach us.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as Jeremy Comeau interviews the team of Jason Cordova and Melissa Altoff on their brand new series, The Bronze Legion, which begins with to tread obsidian shores. And later, we continue with part 44 of One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Nay. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.